Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
In Eastern Syria, let's welcome our guest, Linda Robinson, Director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation. Good morning, Linda. How are you?
Hi, I'm just fine, Tommy. Great to be with you.
Thank you for taking the time with us. So let's start with the most recent, and then we'll work back. The United States carried out attacks, or at least launched some sorties, whatever you want to call them, missile attacks, in Syria on Thursday night. Because of why, and who were they going after?
Yes, so they were going after Iranian-backed militias, and these are Iraqis that have operated both in Iraq and across the border in Syria. The reason the U.S. took the action was that they these militias struck at a U.S. base in Erbil in Iraq, killed an American, wounded several others, and some other foreign nationals working with us. And then this was a really a continuation of what these Iranian-backed militias have been doing, but it was the first one under the Biden administration. So it was a test of how was Biden going to respond. And the difference, whereas the Trump administration had struck back unilaterally, in fact, killing an extremely high-ranking Iraqi who worked with Iran, this one was coordinated with the Iraqi government, which contributed some intelligence for this strike. And it was also after President Biden had made his first call to an Arab leader, which was to the Iraqi prime minister. So the signal is basically it's not going to be unilateral. The U.S. is going to protect its people and stand up for its interests, but it's not going to do it by throwing the Iraqis under the bus, if you will.
And clean this up. I said missile attacks before. It was not. It was sorties and it was bombs that were dropped. What does that say in and of itself, Linda, that we worked with Iraq to do this as opposed to just lone wolfing it?
Well, what it says is it really is a sign that the administration, even though it hasn't put out a Middle East policy per se, its broader rhetoric about working with partners and pursuing diplomatic options as possible as their main resort. It's and the fact that the call went to Prime Minister Karami, it shows that the U.S. isn't going to abandon the country as we have drawn down forces to small numbers. And I should say U.S. was an airstrike that the U.S. took on the Iranian-backed militias, but the strike the Iranian militias waged on us was a rocket attack.
This can get so confusing, and if you're at a desktop, or at a desk rather, somewhere not driving, and you can open up a map of the Middle East, it might be helpful as we go through all of this. There are so many different factions, so many different tribes, so many different religious factions, if you will, countries. I don't know. How in the world do you craft a Middle Eastern policy? It seems to me, Linda, if you're going to put all of these factors together, it's analogous to taking a crystal champagne glass and throwing it on a brick floor as hard as you can, and now let's put it back together. Is it almost that difficult?
It's so complex. You're right. And we'll try to be very clear as we step through this, because there are a number of things at play. And the essential issue has been Iranian behavior. In our new report we have out last week, is we don't think that should be the organizing principle of all U.S. policy in the region. We have a critique we call threatism that is really a very short-term and short-sighted approach. That said, Iran is a problem on a number of fronts and needs to be dealt with. And I'll just quickly break down the overarching strategic concern is the Iranian nuclear program, because they've resumed nuclear enrichment, and this is of a great concern. The U.S. had dropped out of the accord that had restrained Iran with international inspections, and the Biden administration has said they want to get back into diplomacy, to get back into that accord, but stiffen it or beef it up so that it is of a longer term and a stronger accord. And they also are arguing that in tandem, issues that the region really cares about should be addressed. And that is, number one, what we were just talking about, Iranian-backed militias and their support for a number of actors that destabilize the region. And number two, missile proliferation, missile development. Iran had launched an attack on not only shipping. We've just had one that's attributed to Iranian forces on an Israeli tanker, but a very critical strike back in 2019 was against Saudi's Aramco. It disabled an oil refinery, major installation. So those missiles are of great concern to a number of parties in the Gulf.
When it comes to the Iranian agreement, it gets so political, and I just wonder how you can take all of that out. I mean, Republican and Democrat political, as to whether or not it was working, whether it was a weak agreement to begin with. Is the United States better off now than it was then? Were the Iranians complying, et cetera, et cetera? And I could go on for an hour, but generally speaking, walk us through all of that, if you would, please, Linda, and where that all stands with the Iranian agreement.
Yes,
nuclear enrichment, et cetera.
Yes, it's been, as you are correct, it's been a huge political football. The Trump administration withdrew from the accord, having determined that they felt it wasn't a good enough accord. There is, though, one important fact here is that the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, and they are basically charged in the agreement with saying, is Iran in or out of compliance? And they said at the time that Iran was complying with the accord. I believe the major weakness was that those restraints were due to sunset. So while it was a deal that was constraining Iran, it was not a permanent solution. And I think there's general agreement that it needed to be followed on and strengthened, and that's what the Biden administration is trying to do. The problem that's occurred, though, in the interim during the Trump administration, when they got out of the accord and began what was called the maximum pressure campaign, it hasn't produced the intended results of forcing Iran back to the bargaining table. In fact, it caused Iran to break out of the accord and begin this nuclear enrichment, which is now, I think it's some incredibly large number, 12 times over the limit. So they've really gone gangbusters all over this. And so there is an urgent need to get back into negotiations. And what's happening right now is there's a lot of complex back and forth about who does what first or together. And the latest turn of that wheel has been the Biden administration has said while they want to go back in to negotiations, first Iran must return to compliance with the deal, i.e. stop the enrichment. And the comeback from the Iranian side is, no, you got out of the accord first. You're the one that violated it first. You need to come back into compliance. And that means remove the additional series of sanctions that the Trump administration put on. So we're really waiting. And Iran has an election later this spring. And so they're obviously engaging in their domestic politics. Europe, which was a party to the accord, is trying to get all the parties back to the table. But we're kind of in a wait-and-see mode right now. And, of course, Iran is trying to put pressure on the U.S. Through things like this strike.
You can't talk about the Middle East and policy unless you bring in Saudi Arabia. And I guess we'll head there when we come back, Linda, and talk about Jamal Khashoggi and what Joe Biden said when he was running, what the United States should really do about this, if anything, and how important the relationship with Saudi Arabia is as it relates to the Middle East. And do they have to be front and center at the table if we try to craft a Middle Eastern policy that's going to help the United States? This is not simple stuff. That's why we're spending an hour on it. And we're also going to take a step back for those that are not quite familiar and talk about the split between the Sunni and the Shia and where the religious factions enter into this. We're talking about the U.S. and the Middle East. The United States, by a Thursday night, I presume you know by now, bombed Iranian-backed militias in Syria. And who knows what Iran is going to do next. We'll be back in a flash, WWL. So it is 9:24, and we're talking about the Middle East, given the fact that Thursday night the United States ran some bombing missions, sorties is I guess technically what they're called, against Iranian-backed militia in eastern Syria. Excuse me, I'm sorry, it's allergies, not COVID. And we're talking to Linda Robinson, director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation, about crafting under the Biden administration a Middle Eastern policy. So before we get to the Sunni-Shia divide, Linda, let's talk about the killing of this reporter and MBS, and maybe tell us about the relationship with Saudi Arabia and so forth.
So we'll, I guess, start with the news last week was that the Biden administration declassified a report from the U.S. Intelligence Committee, a community, saying that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who was a journalist, a Saudi journalist who wrote for the Washington Post, lived here in the U.S., and he had been, he was killed really for his criticism of the Saudi government and the calls for democratization in Saudi Arabia. It was a particularly gruesome killing. He had gone to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get a certificate he needed to marry his fiancée, who is Turkish. And she was waiting outside the gates. He went in, and he never came out. And he actually was drugged and dismembered, and his body has not been found. But, of course, the Intelligence Committee has means to determine the facts, and this was made known through newspaper reporting, but it was only last week that the U.S. government said, yes, this is the report, and put out the report. So it was a very significant event, and of course the Saudi kingdom, the royal family, the government put out immediately a denunciation of this report as untrue. But it's been widely reported for some time. In addition, the Biden administration put out what it called the Khashoggi ban, which is refuses visas for any officials involved in any type of extraterritorial repression of activists. So it's basically saying these number of people are not allowed to travel to the U.S. And there was a widespread criticism that there wasn't more action taken specifically against MBS, as he's called, the Crown Prince. But there was a significant other step that I will mention, and that is the level of contacts with him was demoted. The White House under the Trump administration, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was extremely close to the crown prince. They talked all the time. They were on WhatsApp all the time. And now, because the crown prince is also the Secretary of Defense, and he's not the ruler. His father, King Salman, is still alive. He's ill. He's aging. But the White House said basically the only official contact that are going to be held with MBS is through the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. And so that really demotes him in another way out of the White House loop. And finally, I'll just say a third event had occurred with the advent of the Biden administration. One of its first acts, really its first act with regard to the Middle East, was to declare an end for offensive weapons and support to Saudi's military actions in Yemen, and specifically some precision-guided munitions that were on order that was held up, declared we would not send those munitions. And it's a signal to the Saudis that the administration will be extremely focused on getting a diplomatic resolution to the civil war in Yemen, but in a way that protects Saudi's interests, because they have been subject to missile attacks by an Iranian-backed group there in Yemen.
So the importance of Saudi Arabia, if you're going to craft a Middle East peace plan or something to keep that area of the world stable, they are a key player, correct?
Yes, even though some countries have recently normalized relations with Israel, Saudi Arabia is still the very dominant player in this arena. And the U.S. has significant, obviously historic, longstanding ties with Saudi Arabia on a number of fronts. And what this amounts to is a recalibration, as Secretary of State Blinken said, of the U.S. relationship. It's not a rupture. It's not saying we will not deal with you anymore, which would, in many people's view, a complete rupture would shoot the U.S. in the foot, because they have so many interests there in the Gulf region and the region at large.
And let me ask you that question. Why is Saudi Arabia so important to us? What do we get from Saudi Arabia? What is it that makes us very deferential in our treatment of them?
Well, the root of the relationship certainly dates back to the oil, energy resources above and beyond, but it's also just a major significant actor. It's the location of Mecca and Medina, the holiest sites in Islam. It is a dominant player in the region. It sits astride critical routes of commerce, and it has been the major customer historically for U.S. arms materiel, military materiel. And you might say, well, is that a relationship that still pertains? And that's part of what our report addresses, because, of course, the U.S. is far, far less dependent on Middle Eastern sources of oil. It's a net exporter now. We have the ability to wean ourselves away from relationships that are purely based on energy. And I think there's a sense under the Trump administration that there was just a real carte blanche given to particularly this new leader, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he's called, that really kind of empowered him to go off the reservation in many ways, holding hostage the Lebanese prime minister, the Khashoggi killing that we were just talking about. He imprisoned a number of princes and the wealthiest people in Saudi Arabia, in the Ritz-Carlton for quite a long time, and extracted a number of resources from them. So it's just a sense that this relationship needs to be reset.
In terms of the gains that were made under the Trump administration with normalization of relations with what countries, what improved under the Trump administration? Let's put it that way, in terms of relationships with Israel, et cetera.
Yes, this was a major achievement, and there actually has been widespread agreement, including President Biden has praised these normalization deals. I think that on the substance of normalizing relations with the United Arab Emirates, which was built on a lot of non-official growing ties between those two countries, but nonetheless a very important formal step. And Bahrain and Sudan followed in turn. And then in the final days, Morocco also was normalized relations. In that latter case, there was an unfortunate concession made. The Trump administration recognized Morocco's claims to the Western Sahara, a region that's been under dispute for decades and is really an unfortunate move that may be relooked by the Biden administration. The reason being Algeria, it's been a process of diplomatic negotiations, and Algeria will have an extremely hard time accepting that move. It's not considered to be conducive to peace in North Africa in a very critical spot.
All right, let's talk about Sunni and Shia. Some people tend to lump Islam all together, there are definitely different factions. And can you talk about that, Linda, and how that has been an impediment to people getting along in that area of the country, that area of the world, rather?
Yes. It has been a great divide in that Iran, which is not only Persian, but also a Shia. And then Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, as we were just talking about, are Sunni. And a critical player in the middle of all this is Iraq. So Iraq, when it was under the rule of Saddam Hussein, the dictator that the U.S. and coalition removed from power in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, he was a Sunni, but really was a Ba'athist dictator. I mean, it's easiest to put it that way. But what happened in the wake of that U.S.-led intervention is that a constitution, a parliamentary system was adopted, and the Shia majority of Iraq has since been the dominant players in Iraq. There's a large Kurdish minority, and there's also a large Sunni minority. So this has really created a kind of unbalancing of the old alignment in the region. So the empowerment of Iran, which has a lot of influence in Iraq now, it has sent lots of support to and militias and its own Revolutionary Guard Quds force to Syria next door to Iraq, and then across into supporting its historic ally Hezbollah in Lebanon. And all of this begins to provide a more threatening and proximate threat to Israel, which has been undertaking its own strikes. I mean, it has mounted a very aggressive defense of its interests in the region, and it is the primary target of Iran. But the Saudis and the Gulf states are also extremely, most of the Gulf states, I should say, are quite opposed to what they see as a more aggressive Iran extending its influence across the region. There's a further complication, and I don't want to derail this. As you pointed out a while ago, this region is so complex. But there's also a division within Sunni Islam, and that is, we could go into that, but there are some frictions within the Sunni dominant states of the Middle East, and particularly Qatar, and as regards relations to Turkey. So there are a lot of cross-cutting frictions in the region.
So what is the main driver? Is it religion? Is that, are those the differences that are causing so many problems in the Middle East? Is it that you got Sunni against Shia, and is it all religion based? Is that the big cause of this?
I would try to boil it down in the following way: states and regime. Sometimes it's important to say, you know, it's a particular regime and power that feels threatened by other states, whether it's because Iran, with a Shia and kind of revolutionary philosophy and an aggressive philosophy, so states feel threatened by Iran. States feel threatened by the by violent extremism, by terrorism, right? We haven't yet talked about that and how that's perhaps in need of being recalibrated. So a lot of concern about, even though ISIS, the Islamic State, has been, its territorial foothold has been dislodged in Iraq and Syria, there is still a large group of insurgents in the thousands, and there is a prospect that that could come back, along with the al-Qaeda elements in the region. The third reason states feel threatened or competitive is what I just mentioned, this specter of political Islam, of Islamist governments coming to power through the ballot box, and that proposing a threat to regimes that do not want and do not trust that Islam, political Islam, can play by the rules of a parliamentary or other governing system.
What's the distinction between Persian and Arab?
Well, it's a completely different ethnicity. Persians are from Iran, and Arabs are basically the rest of the Arab world.
Okay. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back with U.S.-Iranian relations, what's likely to happen, and where does Israel fit in all of this, a major player, and will this area ever be stable, which I don't know how it could be, but I'll see when we come back. 9:39, 21 before 10, time for traffic now, WWL. 9:45, Tommy Tucker, WWL, spending an interesting hour with Linda Robinson, director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation. And if anybody tells you there is a simple answer to peace in the Middle East, they're selling you a bill of goods, because that is not the case at all. When it comes to Israel and the interest there for the United States, how important it is to as an ally to the United States, and what the United States does in return, and the countries there that are against Israel. Can you kind of give us an overview of all of that, Linda?
Well, again, a very complex subset of the many issues in the Middle East. And when people refer to Middle East, historically, they mean Israeli-Palestinian peace. And we were just talking about the Abraham Accords, which were reached between Israel and a number of countries in the region. It was tied to an agreement by Israel that it would hold off on a planned annexation of a large part of the West Bank. And this was strongly criticized because traditional policy has been that the U.S. is pursuing and supportive of a two-state solution, that the Palestinians would, under the Oslo Accords, have their own state and have been moving toward it through the Palestinian Authority construct in Israel. The general perspective is that there's just not been significant progress toward reaching peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Regardless of the good side of the Abraham Accords, the general situation is that the majority of Israeli Jews do not trust the Palestinians and do not want to move ahead to statehood with the Palestinians. So that's just the basic logjam there. And I referenced Secretary of State Tony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, in his confirmation hearings. He basically recognized that there wasn't a clear pathway forward. It doesn't mean it's this agenda, but it just isn't. At this point, there's really not a strong or clear path forward.
So what would be the best possible outcome for the United States in terms of reality and what we could expect under the Biden administration, or what would you advise them to do? Who do you get along with? Who do you disappoint? How do you make both happy?
Well, you've done a very good job in our time here in drawing out all of these many conflicts in the region. And it's certainly understandable that the casual observer might just throw up their hands and say, why should we bother if they're not able to work out their problems? But the problem is that the region does still matter. And there's actually, on top of all the conflicts we've been talking about, there's some very serious long-term issues. This is the region with the highest number of young people in the world. It has the highest number of youth unemployment in the world. It has the highest poverty rate in the world, and it has the largest number of refugees and displaced people in the world. So those problems don't tend to stay in the region. We advocate in this report, we've taken a very serious look at the way in which the U.S. has devoted its various assistance programs, and we find that there's just an overwhelming focus on threat-based thinking that leads us to put more than 80% of all of our military assistance and sales in the world go to the region. 83% of our last aid bill to the region was military. We know there are not a lot of resources to spare these days. The U.S. has many priorities, but we advocate beginning to rebalance, focus away from this high investment in military solutions, and start looking at our other portfolio of measures that we can support along with other countries to try to address some of these basic drivers of conflict. And this is what we feel over the long term can produce better results, recognizing the U.S. can't wave a wand and make all of these conflicts go away. But we do have influence and leverage in the region. And when we were talking about a number of these conflicts a moment ago, the various states are engaged in each other's civil wars. So Yemen, Libya, Syria, there's just a whole Star Wars cast of characters involved in all of these conflicts. And so we also advocate that we really shift to a much more robust diplomatic policy, use the leverage we have, try to get some of these proxies out of these conflicts and reach some basic agreements for resolution of the civil war aspect of these conflicts. And we think there's been a real lack of focus on this. For example, it's the only region in the world that doesn't have its own diplomatic and security forum or security architecture. So what we advocate is looking to the partners. We have Kuwait, Oman, a lot of states have been very strong leaders in various diplomatic initiatives. We advocate putting more emphasis on that and more emphasis on the UN envoys that have been moving forward. Libya now has a ceasefire, but it's not going to last if the U.S. doesn't get aggressive about supporting it and waving off some of the outside actors that are complicating that conflict, which include Russia. Russia is very involved in both Libya and Syria at this point. So it's a complex chess game, but we believe with a new mix of tools, the U.S. can be productive in the region.
I appreciate your time. I really do, Linda. You could, I guess, do a college semester on this, but I appreciate your spending an hour with us. Linda Robinson, Director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation. You know, she talked about throwing your hands up and saying, well, there's nothing we can do about that. And I tend to feel that way, but you can't ignore the area of the world either. Taking a break, coming back, finding out what Noel Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.